I walked out of the theater in such a haze and so distracted that I actually walked into a wall on my way to the bathroom. Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 59, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. Today, I'm joined, as always, by my fellow perfume counter spritzers, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Adams.
Hey, y'all.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today, we're going to be talking about the fantastic new film from director Barry Jenkins, If Beale Street Could Talk. After that, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? Now on with the show. Y'all, I want to just skip the intro banter and get right to entertainment news because I know we're going to talk about the Golden Globes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Let's just do it because I want
All
more
right.
time for that.
Okay. So, actually, you, I know, watched the Golden Globes because you were tweeting them last night. I actually wasn't able to watch them. So
oh my God. I didn't watch them. I can't watch awards
They're
shows.
Boring as fuck, y'all. But there's a couple of moments that are worth talking about.
Yeah. So you tweeted, for instance, Sandra Oh, you know, Sandra, that was perfect. So did she said something on stage as host about wanting to be there.
Part of the reason why I wanted to watch was because it was being hosted by Andy Samberg and Sandra Oh. And like I love Andy Samberg because of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, not really because of anything else he's ever done. And Sandra Oh is a fucking goddess.
Ah, she's incredible.
Right.
I love her so much.
So there was one point on stage where she said, I wanted to host this year at this moment in time because if you look out, this is unlike any other moment in time. And she said that like this might not happen next year. And this might not happen again, but that we need to celebrate the fact that there are these stories that are being told that have never been told before, and that she wanted to be a part of it. And just, I liked how she celebrated it with the caveat of like, let's not kid ourselves, and did it in such an eloquent, simple, powerful way. And fuck yeah.
Yeah. And also, somewhere during that opening, Sandra Oh made a joke about, you know, she said something like, you know, Crazy Rich Asians is like the first film to have an Asian lead since, you know, and then she jokingly referenced some other movie and Aloha. And when she said Aloha, Emma Stone actually in the audience shouted out, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. Yeah. For context, if people don't know, it's an Asian lead played by very white Emma Stone. And she's gotten berated a lot, understandably and appropriately for that. So that was kind of like cool. Like, I'm glad she did that.
Oh, yeah. Me too. So unfortunately, the winners weren't exactly representative of the best.
No, that's the thing, is that like opening speech was so powerful, and then all of a sudden it's like white dude, white dude, white team, white dude.
Yeah, and not only that, but the story. So in the two best picture categories, you know, on one hand you have Green Book winning, which is so emblematic of the problems in Hollywood because it is this film that is entirely ostensibly about racism. Right, but it is itself a racist film in that it centers the racist white guy, you know, over the black man that it should be focusing on, and it kind of presents racism as this just as this like, oh, if we just, you know, look past,
can't we all just get along? Yeah,
yeah, kind of thing. So that was super disappointing to see that Green Book won. And also, I haven't seen Bohemian Rhapsody, but I've sure read a lot of queer writers really take it to task for how it sort of sensationalizes and portrays in a ridiculous fashion Freddie Mercury's sort of struggle with AIDS and his whole queer identity as a sort of venturing into like the seedy darkness, you know, or something like that.
It was definitely, there was a lot of disappointing wins.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is Hollywood, right? That we're at a point where Hollywood is saying, yes, we will we will allow these stories to be told, but it's our version of your story. So it's the white person's version of race in America, or the straight person's version of what it means to be a, you know, queer musical genius, right? Yeah. Like, it's not the stories, it's not own voices, it's not us telling our own stories. It's the folks who have always been in power, who have always been listened to, crafting their version of a story that's very palatable to them. Bye.
And nothing else is more indicative of exactly that as the acceptance speech for Green Book. I hadn't seen Green Book. I didn't know if it was good or not. And that, and I was watching that speech going, oh, this movie can't be good because of the way this guy's talking about it. He's a white dude on stage with almost all white people except for what appeared to be, or the only black people on stage was Octavia Spencer and
Mahershala Ali.
Yeah, Mahershala Ali. Oh, yes. I always say his name wrong. God damn it. And he goes off about how he found this story and it was so powerful and he knew he had to tell it. And he's just going on and on and on. And I was like, oh, cool. Nothing's changed. Right. This is a part of that long legacy of films of white people saving black folks or whatever. Right. Where like The Blind Side and or like Crash or like just the white perspective on racism being so celebrated by Hollywood.
Yeah. Like, how does racism affect white people?
Like, oh, God.
When will someone think about the emotional arc of the white people? I think, you know, if you're interested in Green Book, A, don't go see the movie. Do yourself a favor. Save that $15. And B, go read the responses from Don Shirley's like actual family as to, you know, what this film got wrong.
Yeah.
There was a great tweet last night that said, what do Green Book, Three Billboards, and Crash have in common? Oh, you know, they all won this Golden Globe, right? And they're all like really racist movies that are like that I guess some people view as like progressive or whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they're so self-congratulatory.
Yeah.
You know, they are so smug with this version of like, you know, genteel, you know, kind of awakenings to, you know, the inner humanity of people of color. Oh, God, just miss me with this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have a question. Is Black Panther the only superhero movie that's been nominated as a Best Picture contender?
Oh, boy. I don't know.
Because I'm a bad
media critic.
Yeah, I don't either. I was curious about that because I feel like superhero movies are not considered award winning, right? Unless it's like graphics or some shit.
Yeah.
But shout out to Into the Spider-Verse for winning. I know that we all loved that and very happy for that team to have won that award. So that was good. Do you have other news outside of this or can I do a smooth transition?
No, by all means. Are we already moving on to the main?
Is there more to talk about?
Yeah, we can do that. All right, yes.
Our producer is so annoyed with us.
I didn't watch the Golden Globe, so I feel like I can't, you know, I can't offer anything because I, you know, I consume the Golden Globes via tweets, you know?
It was just boring. I like the way to watch award shows is through tweets, and you just, if you have a good Twitter timeline, it's super fun. But if you don't, then like I was like half cooking and half watching and was like, these acceptance speeches are so boring. And the people who should be winning awards are not, in my opinion. Right. Like it's just like white dude stories are winning again and again. And it's just super frustrating.
Sandra Oh at least did win. Right. For Killing Eve. That is awesome.
Yeah, like, she did win.
Oh, God, I just want to be her friend.
Oh, also we got to talk about Olivia Colman. Yo, you need to watch her acceptance speech because one, I fucking love her and I love her even more now because she seems like the most cool, sincere, interesting woman. Her acceptance speech was just so sweet and adorable and cute and I'm so glad she won and I really want to see that damn movie. Also, I didn't understand the fingering jokes at the beginning, which apparently in the favor, have you all seen it yet?
I have not seen it, but I saw a great clip of Olivia Colman on Graham Norton.
Yes,
talking
that's what I was about to talk
about. And the big wet sponge.
Yeah, she was talking about how Emma Stone was like nervous about accidentally actually fingering her in a scene when that was supposed to happen. so what Olivia did was she got a big wet sponge and like put it next to her cooch. And yeah, I think that's really funny.
Yeah, and the way she mimics Emma Stone's reaction is amazing. Amazing. Go seek out that clip. It was on Graham Norton.
It's real good. It's real. We'll put it in the show notes. But also another person that won that is relevant to today's show is Regina King. She
goddess.
She's amazing. So she won for Best Supporting Actress. Ugh, I hate how gendered this shit is. For If Beale Street Could Talk, which she super deserved because she was amazing in it. And we're going to talk about that today. Hey, y'all. We really want to keep bringing Feminist Frequency to the airwaves in 2019, and we can only do that with your support. So please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. You'll even get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. So again, that's just d.rip/femfreak. All right. If Beale Street Could Talk is director Barry Jenkins' follow-up to his Academy Award-winning 2016 film, Moonlight, and he's made another masterpiece. It's a luminous adaptation of a James Baldwin novel that tells the story of young lovers Tish and Fonny, whose plans for the future are threatened when a vindictive cop has Fonny jailed for a crime he didn't commit, and Tish's family goes to great lengths in a desperate effort to prove Fonny's innocence. That is beautiful, Carolyn. You're so good at writing these descriptions. fun fact, I did not write that gorgeous thing.
Listen, okay. Carolyn has been carrying this show since Seriously. Episode one.
Mm-hmm.
She okay. needs her own podcast.
So Beale Street, If Beale Street Could Talk was nominated for a bunch of Golden Globes. I'm assuming it's nominated for Oscars. If it's not, then that's bullshit.
I don't think the Oscar noms have come out yet, have they?
Right. They have not yet been announced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Before we get into this, I went to watch this movie. I walked out of the theater in such a haze and so distracted that I actually walked into a wall on my way to the bathroom.
Wow.
Like, I just couldn't focus on anything. I'm surprised I, like, actually peed in the toilet. And then, like, on my drive home, I listened to the soundtrack and I shouldn't have been operating a vehicle. Like, I just, this movie has... It sits with you in this way, or it did for me in this way that is so hard to shake, and it's so warm, even in its hardship. And I'm just like, fucking Barry Jenkins is a goddamn genius. Like, it's just this entire thing from beginning to end felt like I keep describing it as warm. I don't know how else to describe it, even though you're like, holy shit, this is awful. Right.
A lot of the reviews and think pieces about this film have used the word immersive, and I think that's one of the things you're getting at, Anita, is that Barry Jenkins and the team that he has put together for this film, from the composers to the lighting directors, you know, everyone involved with this film, has created a world that it is so easy to sink into, like a warm bath of water, and just be submerged in. From the very beginning, we start with this overhead shot of Tish and Fonny, and there's no dialogue, and we're just watching them, and it is the most beatific scene. And you know, the viewer in that moment, we start from the position of sort of like, I don't know. I mean, we are already falling in love with this couple that we don't know yet. But it's like a benevolent God, you know, looking down on these wondrous creatures. And then as the camera slowly brings us down to their level, you know, the process is complete. It takes moments to just absolutely fall in love with these young people and fall in love with the world they inhabit.
There's so much in this film of just... looking at faces, particularly Tish and Fonny's faces, though other faces as well, where, you know, it reminded me of, there's that story or something in the New York Times a few years ago that became this kind of viral experiment or whatever that people would do that said something like, you know, if you like look deeply into somebody's eyes for a 20 seconds or a minute or whatever, you'll feel like connected to them. I feel like there's a sense in which Barry Jenkins lets us just look at these, and they're such warm, open, you know, hopeful, beautiful, beautiful faces that I feel like there is that element of us, of Barry Jenkins just giving us time to like feel connected to these people that is so powerful. And that, you know, this film is warm. It's also, I mean, for all of its dealings with like really harsh, painful, painful, painful realities, there's something kind of dreamlike about it too. And a part of that, at least for me, is just how beautiful every shot is. You know, I thought of there was that old, I mean, not old, but there used to be this series on YouTube about film that was the title of the series was Every Frame a Painting. And that name, that title, that phrase just popped into my head as I was watching this film, because I was like, oh my God, like each shot, you know, is just so gorgeous. Like, oh, and this, they're in their like cramped little miserable, I mean, it's a home, they've made it a home, but they're in their apartment, and oh, but I can see the purple streaming in from the sky through the windows in the back. And I mean, all the colors are just so vibrant, and it's just, I mean, just even to look at, this film is, you know, stunning.
I'm going to say the cheesiest thing I've ever said in my entire life. Are you ready?
Give it to us.
This film shows you how under the most oppressive situations, you can't take people's love away.
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the warmth of this, is that like, no matter how much the world tries to destroy you, right, systemically, culturally, take away everything about who you are and dehumanize you, you can't take away the love of your family and the people around you, and that's what holds you together, even as you're falling apart.
But I think that there's also something kind of, I mean, heroic in that, because I think that a lot of people and Fonny, we do see him like lash out in anger a few times, right? Understandably. I mean, of course, he's in a horrifying, horrible situation nobody should ever have to deal with. But like the fact that, I mean, just the justified anger at the world for its oppression and its cruelty doesn't poison the love that they have for each other is like kind of incredible. Like I think that there is something heroic in people who can still hold on to love and rely on love and draw strength from love, you know, even when they have so many reasons to be so kind of angry or bitter.
And we have the young people who start this film in that position of youth and innocence, and you know, so idealized and so hopeful, and then we have them contrasted with their parents who have been around longer and who know the hardships that life can bring. And there's that great scene between Tish and Fonny's father in the bar where Tish's dad is saying, listen, we know what we have to do, and we know what this life takes, and we're going to do what it takes to keep our kids' heads above water, you know, to keep them free, to keep them alive. That almost like ruthless insistence on surviving and doing what it takes to survive and not letting your spirit be stripped away.
There's a lot of highlighting of different and countering perspectives in this, in terms of how to react to things, how to feel about things, how to approach things. And I feel like they did that primarily through the parents, right? That Fonny's family versus Tish's family. So when Tish, we start the movie really by finding out that Tish is pregnant with, and Fonny's the father, and
we should note that Fonny, at the start of this film, Fonny is 22 and Tish is 19, and that's very important to the story, how young they are.
Yeah. So Tish comes home, and they set up. Oh, God, Barry Jenkins is a genius. They set up the tension so beautifully because Tish is afraid of telling her mother that she's pregnant with this man's baby who's in jail, right? And they're not married and it's the 70s and all of this stuff, right? And there were definitely moments that I cried during this, but one of the things that struck me was how Tish's family responded and the tension of how they set up our expectations of anger and rage to actually be love and affection and excitement in those moments was just like so beautiful to me. And to see a family rally around their daughter in an otherwise situation where otherwise they would probably be pretty angry was so heartwarming. And like the way that they stood up to Fonny's fucking batshit mother together to like build this sort of protective shield around her to make sure that she feels warm and supported throughout this process. Like I don't know. I'm such a sucker for seeing families like that, right?
Yeah, and I think it's really I think I'm really glad that we got the contrast, like the incredibly stark contrast between those two families, right? One, Tish's family is a real family. They love each other. They look out for each other. They support each other. They're there for each other. My God, poor Fonny. Like, I mean, his mother and his sisters are all sort of deeply religious, but it's a cold, ruthless kind of faith that says, oh, you know, Fonny, this is probably all part of God's plan. Fonny, you know, maybe deserves to be in jail and needs this to you know, get himself right or whatever. It's, you know, I mean, it's such a monstrous perspective that, I mean, that contrast then is so powerful between like love makes a family, right? Love and, is what,
yeah,
makes a family.
And also watching Tish, who is very submissive, not in that she's like gonna roll over, but she's quiet and demure and just like kind of goes along. Like she seems like she just kind of goes along with things. And watching her defend herself and watching her fight for Fonny, I thought was a really nice contrast to how she's set up in some ways. There was another scene with her family that like just made me start crying immediately. She is super pregnant and she's very sick. And she walks out into the kitchen and her father made her some tea. And I think her mom is gone. She's left on a trip. And her dad sits down next to her and says, like, and just puts, like, says, lean on me, onto her chest. And I, like, it just, like, you don't see fathers be like that, right? Like, it was so tender and, like, so supportive. And I just, that shit just killed me.
Yeah, I want to go back to this scene where, in fact, I think it's the only scene where we see Fonny's larger family, the scene where, you know, Tish and her family reveal that Tish is pregnant. When we were first coming out of that scene, I wasn't quite sure how I felt about it because it seemed a bit too on the nose after the very sort of authentic and real and honest reactions of Tish's family. Like the movie doesn't rush their reactions, the reactions of Tish's father or her sister. We can see, you know, the fear and the anxiety, and maybe there is a little disappointment, but then ultimately the love and care for Tish weighs out as it should, right? But then when we meet Fonny's family, they come in and they could not be more visually different from Tish's family, right? So everyone in Tish's family has natural hair. The women are wearing trousers versus Fonny's family. The women have straight hair. They're in very sort of buttoned up, you know, the women are wearing, you know, dresses, you know, like very demure, modest clothing. And the acting from those actors seemed to me to be, you know, less naturalistic. Like we knew immediately that they were sort of the villains in that scene, right? In a way that I wasn't quite prepared for, like tonally for the movie to go in. But it struck me as the film progressed that what we have been given through the medium of Tish's voiceovers, we're like, we're a lot of this is an extended reminiscence from Tish. The loving looks we get at Fonny are Tish's loving looks. The immense love that we feel for her family is Tish's immense love for her family, right? So it makes perfect sense that as a reminiscence, Fonny's family would have a sort of heightened, kind of outsized villainy in her recollection. I'm not saying that's what Barry Jenkins intended, but that's certainly the way that I understood that scene. And, you know, like you, Anita, like I'm just in awe of the artistry of this film at every level, the way it's layered with humanity and color and sound and emotion.
Yeah, the sound. So did you notice the sound, how in certain moments that were heightened, the background noise would fade and their voices would elevate?
Yes.
Like just that subtle but very pronounced shifts that happened throughout the film were so dramatic and so it was like putting an exclamation point at the end of a sentence, right? Like where you just it highlighted those moments in a way that was you couldn't have done any other way. Like just those little auditory cues were so powerful.
Yeah, so we're going to put a link to a piece written by Hannah Georges in The Atlantic where she talks to Nicholas Britell, I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly, the composer of the soundtrack, and he talks about from, you know, like the process of this soundscape he created with Barry Jenkins for this film. And the use of like horns and string and silence and, you know, how there are moments like when we meet, I'm blanking on his name. Brian Tyree Henry's character. So there's a scene with Daniel and Fonny in their, you know, Fonny's apartment where there's, Miles Davis music playing, but there's also this kind of insistent beat, underneath. That amps up the tension without us perhaps being, you know, consciously aware of why we're suddenly feeling more tense. It is a masterful, masterful sound design in this film.
Yeah, it is. I was really bummed that they didn't win last night. Not that, whatever, fuck those awards, but like it is so captivating. And I like if you listen to the soundtrack, like it's just it takes you back into that world. Like it's so good. Sorry. I don't know where he's going with that. I got nothing.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
His wife's head is in the box.
Well, I wanted to talk about the actual accusation and the way that they dealt with that.
Go ahead.
So when you find out that it is Fonny that's being accused of raping a woman and she is Puerto Rican, and that it's a false accusation, I was like, uh-oh. Like, right? You're just like, how is this going to be handled? And I was, the way that they handled that, I thought they did it very well for what it was. Like, there was no, there were many comments about, like, we really do believe she was raped. And we really do believe that, like, that's a horrible thing to happen and that she is in pain, but that it wasn't Fonny. Right? And so the issue isn't, like, discrediting the survivor as much as it was like she's being pressured by this cop to accuse this guy. And she's like, I can't, she's so traumatized that she just wants to be done with it.
Yeah. This film had a very, very tricky needle to thread with that storyline because any hint of a suggestion that, you know, the rape accusation itself was false or that this is somehow endemic, that, you know, women be lying or whatever, would have completely collapsed this thing like a house of cards. But this film was so tender with Victoria, the victim of this film, and really took pains, I think, to emphasize that what she experienced was real and that the protection of the people around her made sense. And that, you know, that Tish's mother, she says, I'm a woman and I know what women know. That it was killing her to have to do this but she felt that there was no other choice, even though the film, I think, does, you know, show us that she goes too far when she's holding Victoria and physically kind of, you know, almost shaking her, that this is like, we absolutely, you know, sympathize when she, you know, breaks down at the end and she's like, because she knows that she's gone too far. It was a brutal scene to watch.
That was just, you're sitting there watching her. And like in my head, I was like, in any other movie, it would be like, okay, she's going to have a new plan, right? Mm-hmm. Like she'll figure it out, because that's what superheroes do, right? Like that's mm-hmm. what happens in movies. And you just see her be like, I fucked up and I ruined this and we're not coming back.
Yeah.
Like that was my one shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was excruciating to watch. And granted, like you kind of know what's going to happen, right? Like there's no way this movie's ending on an uplifting note in this regard, at least, because it's James Baldwin, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, and we also know that, like, you know, this very particular story of Tish and Fonny's and, you know, their larger family and even their street, you know, Beale Street, their community, right? This is part of a larger sort of, you know, historical, you know, fact of life, right? So we have the addition in the film of like these occasional sort of black and white scenes. You know, it's almost as if it's a documentary. Scenes from like prison camps and, you know, police encounters with civilians, brutal encounters with, you know, police and civilians. Like we know how this plays out. And there's that growing dread, but also just the profound weight of melancholy that there's no way we can wipe out what has happened to Fonny. There's no way we can wipe out what has happened to Daniel. The scene with Daniel where he's talking about what his experience was like in prison broke me. Yeah. I mean, if there was anything that I wanted more of in this film, it was more Brian Tyree Henry as Daniel.
And the code switching that he does, mm-hmm. like where he's like trying to be cool and together and then like being vulnerable, like and being like, I have to share this with someone, basically. And like watching him go back and forth as Tish walks back in, for example, yeah. and just being like, can I have another beer? Can I have another beer? Can I have another beer? Like,
yeah,
Can we talk about the weird cameos that were in this?
As long as you don't talk about the one that you know got on my
literally,
last
he walked on the screen, and
girl.
I was like, "Oh God, Ebony!" Like I literally muttered
right,
that
thank
under
you.
My breath.
Thank you, because you know how I feel about the Francos.
I know
there's too many of them.
So
there's too many
cameos by Diego Luna, which I thought was really lovely. That like
yeah.
watching that scene where Tish is like watching Fonny outside of the community that I know him in, interacting with other people, like in his own element. And like that, I loved that relationship. I loved her view. Ebony, what you were saying, I think, is dead on, that we see the movie through her eyes and that sort of. That like warmth and affection that you when you watch a partner interact in the world kind of like it translated so well onto camera, right? And the fact that they walk in there and they're like, we have no money, help us, and he was like, yeah, I got you, right?
Yeah. And then there's that great scene of the two couples dancing. Yeah, Diego Luna's character in this is part of one of my favorite things about the film. So his character and then the character of the woman who owns like the little bodega, the shop where Tish shops. Before they have that run-in with that horrific cop, right? But the shop owner who comes out and defends the two kids, like, it was just the kind of micro worlds. This is something I talked about in Intro Into the Spider-Verse, right? There's something about, like, those urban micro worlds. And when we get specifically New York versions of them, I am helpless. They are my kryptonite, you know? Like, the way you talk to people on your street, on your block, the way you know each other, in a way that it feels so foreign to people who didn't grow up in that way. Like, if you grew up in a kind of rural environment, you know, you may know your rural community, but there's something about that kind of proximity that allows for a certain kind kind of intimacy and deep knowledge that I love the way Jenkins captured that on the screen with those two different characters.
And I think some of it is also the beauty. I mean, I haven't read this particular James Baldwin book, so I don't know if this was a Barry Jenkins adding it or in the book, but I think that it's very telling who he's chosen to have as those people that are in solidarity with them, right? They're Jewish and they're Latinx. Mm-hmm. And there are other people that are very, that are a part of the fabric of New York life and that are a part of the fabric of like being persecuted in different ways, right? And that there is a solidarity there between them in these ways that can be surprising when it comes to Dave Franco's character, who is a, he's Jewish, who is trying to rent out a space. And part of the tension in this, the movie, is that Tish and Fonny can't find housing because they're both Black. And so that, like, that was just another example of those as the same as those two other characters who just, they're kind of like, I get it, right? They're like, we see you and we feel you, and like the power of that, where the only real white person is the shitty cop, but there's also the white lawyer, which they're also like, yeah, he's a lawyer, he's kind of a smarmy dick, whatever, but he like learns through this process. Like, he's not important really, but you do see him like getting really invested in how corrupt the justice system is, and I did appreciate that.
There's the monologue where they say something like, you know, he realized that pursuing this case was, you know, making him an enemy to, you know, to these powerful people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that insight was really valuable.
Yeah. And also the fact that, you know, you have this very talented, smart, but individual white dude on their side is not enough to overcome the weight of like the systemic issues Mm-mm. that are weighing down. Like, you know, this is not going to be some white savior swooping in and undoing the horrific thing that Fonny has experienced. Like, that's not the way the world works. And I think in another lesser movie, that's absolutely what would have happened.
I have a question. So, you know, the monologue at the end about plea deals and how they, mm-hmm. you know, Fonny pleas out. And so they talk about the systemic injustice of the way that we do this, where most people plea out and they take jail time because the court system is so backed up, I guess.
And fucked.
I kind of feel like that's a more modern thing in the last like several decades. But has that just been going on forever? Like, was that common in the 70s, or was that added to the film?
No, I think it is, or was rather. The motivations for it maybe changed generationally. But I think that the implication is that Fonny took a plea because if you take a plea to a lesser charge, you aren't going to, you know, have the fear of going down for a, it's like what Daniel did, right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
So I think that's always been around.
Yeah.
And the ease with which that happens and the way that it is normalized, such that there's no question that this happens and it happens with regularity and that people just have to do their best to live with that brutality. There's that scene, you know, once Tish she's really pregnant at this point and comes to see Fonny. And at this point, the trial has not happened yet. And he's clearly been in a fight. And his face is so beat up. And there's no mention of it. Like, there's no discussion of it. It's just one more thing that he has to deal with.
I just kept thinking about how she was in pain and he reached out for her, mm-hmm. and how like he literally never felt his baby kick.
Yeah.
Like, he never held his boy when he was born. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just constantly behind glass the whole time. And like that, I just, you know, one of the things that strikes me about this film and like really, really good filmmaking, you know how you watch a movie and you're like, oh, you're trying to weave all these threads together and it's either super cliched, super predictable, or they just don't work. Like, you're trying to do too much. Like, they're just films that
sure,
exist
sure,
like
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
yeah, like, this film did so much so effortlessly.
Yeah.
Like it weaved together all of these pieces. It never felt stuffy. It never felt like contrived. It just, it was so smooth that it is my favorite.
It was so good. If there was no dialogue in the film
yes.
at all, I would have loved
like,
it.
Like, this is not a movie. So this is a movie that Carolyn should be in love with and I should be bored by. Like, this is totally that division. And I was like, they would do these shots. Like, they did a lot of upward shots on their faces. They would do a lot of head-on shots and just their expressions. And I was like, oh, don't cut away. Why are you cutting away? Let's just stay here. Let's just stay looking at these beautiful faces and their expressions and the music, right? Like, I was like, slow down, y'all.
That's something that I also have never said in a movie. Slow down. You're going, you know, too
I've
fast.
I've never
I
said
look
that.
Look at this longer. Fully two-thirds of my notes about this film are about visual moments that just blew me away. So, Carolyn, you were talking about like every frame picture.
A painting.
So, you know, there's the opening that I talked about with this just, oh my God, the warmth of those yellows and blues, how the couple kind of match in that opening shot with they're both wearing yellow and blue, and then the yellow of the autumn leaves surrounding them. The scene where they, you know, realize like, oh, they may have that loft apartment, and Fonny lifts Tish up in the street, and it's kind of dusk, and there are those lights, you know, out of focus in the background. It's a storybook. It is a Renaissance painting. It is so amazing to just... But it's also, while at the same time that it's so visually stunning, it's also incredibly tactile. The textures of this film, it looks like something you could reach out and touch. You know, there's the very first time that we see Tish talking to Fonny in jail with that glass between them. I was amazed by how the shot is photographed or is filmed such that you can see like... through the glass, like the details of her zipper and like the weave of her shirt. And then when it's reversed, you can see like Fonny's like just little bits of his chest hair or the hair on his face. Like, it's such a tactile movie. It is just, it's a feast for the senses. It truly is. That's so corny, but it is.
And that sort of tactility or that really comes through. There's a scene that I think really reveals, I mean, Tish has a piercing intelligence. You know, she's kind of mm-hmm. meek or quiet on the surface, but the film lets us into her intellect, and we see the way that she's able to, you know, almost with like a surgical scalpel-like precision, kind of identify the sort of social forces that she is caught up in the midst of. And, you know, I really love that scene where she's talking about working behind the perfume counter at the department store. And she talks about how, oh, you know, sometimes a black man will come up and he'll interact with me this way. You know, a white man, a wealthy white man will like have me spray my own hand and bring it up to his mouth and sniff and, you know, say thank you and walk away. And I mean, like the tactility, like, you know, that scene kind of made me cringe because I was feeling like that kind of, you know, that sort of entitlement to Tish's body that kind of comes, that those white men may feel, that comes with her position behind the perfume counter, but also just like in awe of her intelligence and her way of really just breaking down, like, what it means to be this black woman in this position, in this white, you know, sort of upper class establishment.
She's so young. She's so young. And I'm so old. I wanted to reach into the screen and cradle her in my arms, you know, when Fonny talks about how he can't let her go look at apartments anymore on her own because, you know, people will try and take advantage, like predators out there. And I just, I wanted to protect her. And the fact that I couldn't, I felt like her mean auntie, you know, like I just didn't want anything else to happen to this lovely, lovely young lady. Oh my God. I could watch this movie 17 more times in a row.
And I just want it on background, new. Like just on every wall, just around, please.
Yeah, and like you, Anita, immediately walked out and got the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Like immediately.
Yeah. All right, y'all. If you, I highly recommend seeing this in theaters if you get the opportunity.
Me too.
I feel like you need that like surround sound, big picture to really immerse yourself
just
in
the
this.
The color of this film, seeing it on the big screen, and the, as I said, the composition of the shots, you can really appreciate it. So I think it so much more when it's on the big screen.
Yeah. Please, please go see it. You won't regret it. And if you don't like it, then you suck. All right.
Well,
before we move
that's
into
just math.
Yeah, exactly. Before we move into what's your freak out, I forgot to mention in the entertainment news that Alfonso Cuarón won a few awards for Roma.
Oh,
last night.
Wonderful.
And I just wanted to point that out because he is from Mexico and we love him. And I didn't see Roma, but, you know, at least it's not.
It's magnificent. It's a magnificent film. I mean, it is a film that, you know, it focuses on, it really puts this this brown, you know, Mexican woman, native Mexican woman, at the center of the story. She's like that. She's, you know, a maid, like a cleaning woman for this upper class family. And normally those characters are kind of are the side characters, you know, they're supporting. But it really puts this woman in her life and her experiences front and center, and experiencing like the way that you experience this period of time through her eyes is it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah. So yeah, congratulations to him. He made the best Harry Potter movie, so he'll always be good in my books. All right, it's time for What's Your Freak Out? Carol, I'm going to let you start because we basically steamrolled that entire conversation.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's totally fine. All right, so my freak out this week is the game The Return of the Obra Dinn. This is the new game by Lucas Pope, who is the, you know, previously known for creating Papers, Please. Return of the Obra Dinn is a very, very different game, but it is no less kind of remarkable in its own way. The basic premise of the game is that you play like an insurance inspector. It's set in like the early 1800s, and you play an insurance inspector for the Honorable East India Company that's very concerned that one of their ships carrying valuable cargo, you know, went missing some years ago, and now the ship has like mysteriously just reappeared, but there's not a living soul aboard. And so you go aboard, you have this magical pocket watch that lets you go back to the precise moment, like the instant of like any crew member's death. So what happens is you find, say, you know, a corpse or like the place where somebody died on the Obra Dinn. And you use your magic pocket watch, and you go to this moment that is like frozen in time, like droplets of rain are just hanging in the air or whatever. Like it is totally frozen, but you can move around in this like frozen tableau of any given moment. And you have to be so you're basically, your job is to catalog, how did each person die? You know, who is each person? How did they die? And you have to be so observant. You know, you really, so many games sort of have like half-hearted detective mechanics, right? Where the main character might be deducing things, but you, the player, really don't have to do much deduction. In this game, you really have to use your deductive reasoning skills to like rule people out or rule people in and determine what happened. And it's just so intellectually satisfying to, you know, to realize that you are getting it, that the pieces are kind of gradually falling into place, and you're kind of piecing together the fate of like what happened aboard this derelict ship that met such tremendous misfortune on the high seas.
Awesome.
So, I love a good derelict ship adventure. Is this available on Steam? Can I play this on my computer?
You absolutely can. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Sweet. So anyway, I recommend if you're into the idea of like really, putting your deductive reasoning to work, I highly recommend Return of the Obra Dinn. It's super satisfying in that regard. And challenging. Very challenging, but very
rewarding. Then I can't play it.
I know. You can.
All right, Ebony, what's your freak out this week?
My freak out this week is that I have finally gathered the courage to, and I have not done it yet, but I'm about to start watching the Surviving R. Kelly series.
I want to watch that. We should watch it together.
I think we should, and we really need to talk about it. Now, I wasn't like this docuseries needed to convince me. Like, I already knew Robert Sylvester Kelly is a goddamn predator. So that's the end of it, the story on that. But I want to hear these survivors' stories, and I want to honor them and the incredible journey and hard work they've had to do to talk about these things. So my freak out is that I'm getting there. My freak out is that it seems to me this is another instance right now where the vast, overwhelming majority of the people who are talking about R. Kelly and about his victims are Black women. And I just want to say, white feminists, where the fuck are you? Where the fuck are you? Like, if you're not going to show up for us, what are y'all doing? You know?
I mean, do they ever?
Okay, but I'm just saying. Like, the fact that over this weekend, almost everybody in my Twitter timeline was talking about Surviving R. Kelly, and then the associated hashtag mute R. Kelly, because this dude needs to be taken down. But that those people were 99.9% Black women, and I'm hearing crickets from other communities, just galls me. It just galls me. I want to hear none of y'all fix your mouths to say shit else about hashtag me too, if you don't have something to say about R. Kelly and the young girls. He has been for decades. This dude has been doing this for decades. There is so much we need to talk about how we need to be so much better about how we think about victims and abusers, especially abusers who were themselves victims, what restorative justice looks like, who's talking about this issue, who isn't, who gets believed and who isn't. There's so much, and it's very tricky, but it is so necessary. So that's my freak out. I fully expect to be emotionally just not able to deal next week when I, come back after watching these six episodes, but I'm going to do it because I think it has to be done. It's the least I can do. It's the least.
Did you hear that bullshit about how his download, like his music's being downloaded more because of the documentary?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is wrong with people?
Fuck every one of y'all. Yeah. Fuck every single one of y'all who did that.
And I did see a tweet come across. I saw a tweet come across my timeline where someone was at a club and Ignition came on and the whole crowd booed.
Good.
Which I was like, wow, that's great. But also, that should have happened fucking 20 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you. And if you have, if you're in the music industry and you haven't made a statement about this, you're a coward.
Mm-hmm.
You're a fucking coward. So anyways, that's my freak out. Go for it, Anita.
Cool. Thanks. My freak out is Aquaman.
Oh my God. I can't wait to hear what you thought of this movie.
Oh, me too.
It's bad. My freak out is over.
No.
What?
You got to give me more than that.
All right. My one of my really good Swedish friends is in town and she
humble brag.
Yeah, I have friends in Sweden. What? Anyways, she really, for whatever reason, her and I always watch bad shit together, mostly because of her. Like, she was the one that, if you remember, we watched all of the Twilight movies in one weekend.
Why do y'all do that to yourself?
She does it, and then she ropes me into it. I really did not want to go see this movie. Anyways, I really, I wasn't going to go see it. I had no interest in it. I was slightly curious about why people were, speaking positively of it and talking about, the biracial politics of it and all this shit, but not enough to make me see it. And y'all know how much of the hots I have for Jason Momoa and how that has gone away because he's a fucking asshole and does stupid, childish bullshit and not terrible thing and terrible things. So I was like, just I'm not here for this. I went to see it. Here's the thing. It's not good. There's literally nothing good about it. I'm not saying whatever. I think the reason people like it is because it's kind of on par. Like, it is solid enough, like Wonder Woman was solid enough. And Wonder Woman is better, but it's that definitely that level of like, oh, this is like a competent movie. And so people get excited about it. The politics in it that they tried to include were so shallow, like so embarrassingly shallow. The B plot is about there's a black father and his son, and they're pirates, and they raid submarines on like the open seas, and that the son's grandfather, was a veteran, and he. He was a war veteran. He was really great at doing war things, whatever. And then the government abandoned him. And so he became a pirate. And so now they're all pirates. And then Aquaman comes in and saves the fucking Russians or Ukrainians or whoever the hell were being attacked. And then the father dies. And so now the son is like seeking revenge. So that's the whole B plot. And he becomes a giant praying mantis at some point. It's fucking stupid.
What? That sounds awesome.
The other thing, well, it's just I have no patience for this revenge bullshit. Like, it's just it's so weak and stupid. The other thing is that like the whole narrative is predicated on the idea that there's the underworld, like the sea world, and then there's the land people, and that they're two totally different worlds, and that Aquaman is the bridge between them, but he doesn't want to be because he's like, fuck those people who killed my mom, blah 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 blah. So humans on land have destroyed the ocean, and so they want to wage war on humans on land, and so it's blah 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 blah, and then Aquaman has to come and whatever. I don't know why I'm telling you all these details. It's not good. It's super romanticizing of monarchy. It's men as leaders and women do all the fucking work. Amber Heard is actually really good in it. Like, I like her a lot. There's one scene.
How unsettling is her wig? Like, do you ever get used to it?
Yeah, it's fine. Like, you think of her as a mermaid, really, is what happens.
You think of her as a mermaid.
I mean, she's got red hair like Ariel. Come on. There are some jokes about masculinity, like they're sort of subtle. The outfits are really sexualized, like the fact that she's super booby the whole time, and like that, you know, like it's the thing that really struck me and why like I aggressively hate this movie is that the dialogue is so predictable. Like, it's like it is the cheesiest, most predictable dialogue that you literally know what they're about to say word for word before they say it every fucking time, right? It's not only that the narrative and the pacing and all of that, you know what's coming. You understand all the motivations. They're stupid, cliched. It was written by a goddamn machine. But, like, how do you have every cliched sentence in the world in one movie? So, yeah. The only thing I will say is that there are two scenes that I really loved that were really beautiful. There's a scene where they're fighting, where they have to use flares underwater to fight these enemies that, like, are attacking them. And it's just this gorgeous CGI where they're, like, where they're swimming through with this light with all of these creatures following them. That was it. Oh, and then there's a scene with Amber Heard's character where she, like, you see female rage in the most beautiful way, where she's about to explode. She explodes these wine bottles and it's just like red, fiery liquid behind her as she's about to like take down a bunch of dudes. Those two things were awesome. I would like that GIF. So if anybody can GIF that for me, that would be great. All right. I talked way too much about Aquaman. I wasn't even going to say anything about it because it's so bad.
You were freaking out.
It's not good. Y'all, it's not good. All right, that is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available as a backer of this podcast, which you can be. So just head over to d.rip/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. And when you are at your favorite Italian restaurant with your favorite Italian server, he's not Italian. I don't know why
no,
I said that.
He isn't.
Whatever. Tell your friends about us. Please leave us a review and rate us. It really helps. And you can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And be sure to follow us at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at Lena Waithe, call me.
Ooh. Did you see her eyebrows? Ugh.
I saw it all, baby.
Shit. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, techno support by Sarah Narales, production assistance by Taylor Simmons, and art by Jamie Varon. Bye.
Bye.
Later.